This is Tom Allen with the third of the Energy Chronicles, titled From Edison to Enron. If you pay the bills in your house, I'm sure you've noticed your electricity bills have gone up. In Seattle, we're paying 60% more than we did 18 months ago. Why are electric rates going up? In the next half hour, we'll look into the reasons. During California's electricity siege of the last two summers, I'm sure many of us felt for those poor souls in California who were experiencing rolling blackouts. But we also felt outrage at the Columbia River water being used to generate California power rather than float salmon to the sea. In the summer of 2000, who of us ratepayers knew that the California power crisis would spread up north? But it has. If you're outraged at having to pay 60% more for your electricity, you're in good company. Washington Attorney General Gregoire has filed suit in federal court against the officers of Enron, Wall Street banking houses.
We're suing each of these entities because it's the best way to get them and others to clean up their acts. When we sue the tobacco companies, yeah, there's a lot of money involved. It's the largest financial settlement in the history of the world. But you know what's much more important than that? It's the injunctive relief we got in the complaint, so that they can't do that stuff again. Enron is not going down, it's reorganizing. If we get nothing else out of this, let us get injunctions to make sure that these folks can't do this again. Why would I insist on that? I'll be blunt with you, because I don't think FERC is gonna stand up and do its job. And I also know that the other regulatory agencies are underfunded to do their job.
Initially, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, had refused to intervene in the California debacle with rate caps or otherwise, and the Attorney General's pleas fell on deaf ears. But after a flurry of memos describing the trading strategies, Attorneys General filed for reconsideration. Quoting Washington Attorney General Gregoire in papers filed with the FERC on May 28th, quote, "Electric utilities throughout the West, not just California, suffered because of Enron's manipulative tactics. As a matter of fairness, Pacific Northwest utilities should be allowed to make a case as to why they are entitled to recover those costs." April 2000 press reports indicated that Vice President Dick Cheney had met with Enron CEO Kenneth Lay the day before announcing that he, Cheney, would not support price caps on the sale of wholesale electricity in California. Enron was at the time in the midst of a full-scale PR campaign to block such price caps. A General Accounting Office investigation has met with predictable White House stonewalling. If you've been following the news, you know that the two largest California utilities, Southern Cal Edison and Pacific Gas and Electric, are in bankruptcy. The state of California floated nearly $9 billion in bonds so that the two bankrupt utilities could continue to buy power. California Governor Davis has demanded, and recently gotten, agreement to renegotiate $40 billion in forward contracts at double the current price. FERC has belatedly undertaken an investigation of possible price manipulation in the recently deregulated California energy market. Governor Davis has called the investigation an outrageous whitewash. The bankrupt Enron, which purchased Portland General Electric in 1997, has sold off PGE's energy trading operations to UBS Warburg, a Swiss investment banking house. It's not clear what the fate for the rest of PGE will be, but I learned in late July that a citizen group in Portland is attempting to turn PGE into a public utility. BPA will have to raise wholesale rates by 11% this fall. BPA did business with Enron, buying and selling power. Their portfolio now includes forward contracts for nearly $700 million worth of Enron power. These Enron contract prices averaged about double the current market rates. Seattle City Light has raised rates by 60% in the last 18 months to cover for several long-term forward contracts bought in a panic for power they don't now need and must resell at a loss. The Seattle City Light rate increase reflects more than $520 million in short-term buys of wholesale power, including $136 million contracted directly with Enron. A City Light planner has told me that they are fearful of not being paid by several of the PUDs they supply. And now, the FERC has given utilities in the BPA service area 75 days to explain why a California-style RTO, or regional transmission operator, should not be implemented here in the Northwest. Managing electricity distribution in the Northwest is what Bonneville Power Administration already does, but in a regulated environment. At a meeting in Portland in June, 22 Washington and Oregon public utilities asked BPA to withdraw support for the RTO, in effect saying, "Create all the open markets you want, but do it somewhere else." Washington Congressman McDermott has come out in opposition to this policy, and Attorney General Gregoire has made no secret of her opposition to deregulated electricity. And to top it all off, the financial shenanigans of high-stakes financiers in both electric and telecom are dragging the stock market down with them, along with a lot of IRAs and 401k retirement plans. What a mess. Well, how did it get this way?
You may find yourself living in a shotgun shack. You may find yourself in another part of the world. You may find yourself behind the wheel of a large automobile. You may find yourself in a beautiful house with a beautiful wife. You may ask yourself, well,
it may seem that the events of the past couple of years have just popped up like so many mushrooms in the spring lawn, but like the mushrooms, much remains beneath the surface that endures over time, only to pop up at the most opportune moment. So to help make sense of the current events in the utility industry, I offer the following story to place the current debacle in an historical context. As you will see, there are some interesting parallels between our present situation and the past. The history of the electric utility industry is filled with intrigue, with backroom deals, monopolies, stock manipulation, bribery, propaganda campaigns, and violence reminiscent of the movie Chinatown, which was about water utilities in Los Angeles. By 1900, a battle raged for technological supremacy amongst electricity equipment makers. Thomas Edison fought with his benefactor and investor, J.P. Morgan, over whether to manufacture distributed DC systems or adopt the AC systems favored by George Westinghouse. Morgan had refused to finance the expansion of Edison's DC generator business because of an important but perhaps overlooked technical detail. That is, that AC voltage can be changed with transformers, while DC cannot. The technical and business structure that developed over the next century depended on this law of physics. Edison's early systems were for low-power DC lighting, with a range limited to about half a mile because of the power losses imposed by longer wires. The solution to the line loss problem was high voltage, but high voltage required for long-distance transmission could not be brought into homes and businesses. Transmitting high-voltage AC and transforming it lower before it entered the home or business solved this problem. The significance of this is that while Edison saw himself as a manufacturer of lighting equipment, Morgan saw that the way to make real money in the electric high-tech business of the time was to create a monopoly and sell electricity. Because of the limited range of low voltage, Edison believed he could sell vast numbers of generators and lights. But by 1885, only 6 years after Edison demonstrated the first incandescent light bulb, the electrical equipment business had become cutthroat and equipment had become low-profit commodities. DC systems couldn't be monopolized, it was clear. But with an AC system, Morgan could consolidate many small utilities. And with a grid of transmission lines, he wouldn't be selling just equipment. He'd be selling electricity. And if he owned the wires, customers would buy it from him. Morgan didn't achieve a monopoly in his lifetime, but his son, J.P. Jr., did. It took until 1935, but he did it. and he did it right here in the Pacific Northwest, helped in no small part by the mighty Columbia River and a pyramid of holding companies he established called Electric Bond and Share. Ultimately, Edison lost control of the company he founded, Edison General Electric, to Morgan. Once in control, Morgan began gaining control of the small utilities to which General Electric sold equipment. He did this by financing the equipment through Drexel, a bank he owned, and by buying utilities on the cheap when they went bankrupt in the financial panics that occurred every few years. We appear to be experiencing such a panic now. Electric Bond and Share eventually became one of the nation's largest utility holding companies, controlling 15% of the electricity in the U.S. By 1930, the company had become part of a web of 29 holding companies on top of holding companies and subsidiaries reaching all across the world. Between Morgan & Company and J.P. Sr.'s associates Charles Stone and Edwin Webster, owners of Puget Power, they controlled all but a tiny fraction of the power generated in Washington State. Oregon fared little better, with power controlled by only three holding companies. Except for the Panhandle, Idaho and Montana were entirely in Morgan's clutches. Predictably, this concentration resulted in a very profitable business for the power trusts. Through the speculative mania of the 1920s, it became far more profitable to sell securities in electric utilities than to operate them. The mania became so pervasive that holding companies sprang up for the sole purpose of selling utility bonds. But most of the investing was done by companies investing in each other, creating a vast web of interlocking management. The interlocking directorships and stock ownerships of the various companies created a bewildering web of financial obligations in which profits of the lowest tier companies paid the interest on the bonds held by companies in the next higher tier. According to economist John Kenneth Galbraith in his study of The Great Crash of 1929, this extreme leverage and pyramiding was one of the five reasons for the Great Depression. The purchase of securities was leveraged with loans from banks and stock sales to banks. The Glass-Steagall Act had yet to be passed. The act would have prevented banks from owning and selling stocks. During the Great Depression, the profit of the operating companies on the bottom tier fell to the where they couldn't pay the interest, and the whole pyramid collapsed. Investors had been attracted to utility stocks, then as now, in part by the prospect of investing in geographically dispersed utilities that they expected would be immune to regional economic storms. Samuel Insull, once president of Edison General Electric, had amassed a similar pyramid in an attempt to stop Morgan from monopolizing the entire utility industry. He controlled Commonwealth Edison and most power in Western Oregon. Through various syndications, Insull controlled more than $800 million per year in bond income and was a serious challenge to Morgan's would-be monopoly. In September 1929, just before the crash, Samuel Insull gained control of a key property, Portland General Electric. This blocked Morgan's monopoly in the Northwest. But Morgan calculated that to take control of Insull's properties, their stock price would have to be about 25% of their 1929 value. At that time, Morgan had more than 30 traders on the New York Stock Exchange and was able to manipulate stocks at will. Through wash sales, short sales, and other sophisticated devices, he was able to depress stock prices of Insull's many holdings. In October 1929, the stock market began its crash. In 1930 and 31, Morgan engaged in a series of complex banking deals involving issuance of worthless securities and bribery. Morgan acquired enough bonds of Central Pacific Service Corporation, PGE's parent company, to eventually force the bankruptcy of Portland General Electric. And by 1935, he had succeeded. Morgan's actions were later deemed fraud, but for the moment at least, he and his protégés, Stone and Webster, had a monopoly on all electricity in the Pacific Northwest, except for the municipal utilities Seattle, Tacoma, and McMinnville, Oregon.
You may ask yourself, where does that highway lead to? You may ask yourself, am I right? Am I wrong? You may say to yourself, by God, what have I done?
An early act of the Roosevelt administration was the Public Utilities Holding Company Act of 1935. But the end for electric bond and share didn't come until public utilities gained strength in the 1940s. Finally, in 1946, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the SEC's 1942 order based on the 1935 law, terminating control of Morgan's empire over Northwest operating companies and dissolving his pyramid. The court said in part, quote, "The highly pyramided holding company system makes those in control at the top neglect good management of operating companies, exaggerate profits, seek exorbitant profits, magnify the rate of earnings, and promote extravagant speculation." This, 17 years after Morgan precipitated the crash of 1929. Washington Attorney General Gregoire.
Each of these companies, together with Arthur Andersen and Enron, were part, in our estimation, of this scheme that went on to defraud the investors, to defraud the employees, to defraud America. As leader in their fields, their companies should be, in my estimation, the model of integrity. You ought to be able to fully trust them, because as bankers and financial advisors and accountants, integrity has got to be their stock and trade. But in pursuit of higher profit, they apparently have abandoned those ethics, and they have traded their integrity for cash.
Same as it ever was. 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 Same as it ever was.
Since before World War I, the model for electric power in the Northwest and elsewhere had been that of a regulated monopoly or common carrier whose rates were set by state and federal regulatory agencies. Rates were based on capitalized costs plus a fair profit, or in the case of municipals, rates were based on costs. When I questioned Senator Cantwell about her stand on electricity deregulation, she responded with the following background. Quote, "In December 1999, FERC issued Order 2000, requiring utilities under its jurisdiction to examine the formation of RTOs nationwide. It may interest you to know that the move toward RTOs actually has its roots in legislation enacted in response to the energy crisis of the 1970s. Congress passed the Public Utility Regulatory Policies Act in order to force energy companies to diversify their sources of generation in a way that would reduce our country's reliance on foreign oil imports by allowing, for the first time, independent power producers to build new, more efficient sources of generation to compete with incumbent utilities. PURPA also created the need for open access to the nation's transmission system so that these new entities could bring their power to market," end quote. With this and other 80s deregulation as precedents, the investor-owned utility industry set about lobbying for a completely open market. Eventually, Enron was able to create a market completely outside the purview of the Chicago options market, overseen by the Securities Exchange Commission, who usually overseas commodities markets. Enron's market traded pipeline capacity, electric transmission line capacity, fiber optic telecommunications capacity, and electricity. It could be that truly open markets, based on instantaneous supply and demand, are more efficient and will unlock pent-up value, but that isn't what happened. I won't repeat what you no doubt have read about in the newspapers by now about Ricochet, Get Shorty, Death Star, and the rest of the trading scams. Except to add that Enron's trading for the West Coast was done in PGE offices in Portland, and it appears that PGE participated with Avista in the Ricochet scheme. Avista is the former Washington Water Power, one of Morgan's companies. Peter Navarro, a professor of business at the University of California, Irvine, studies the energy industry. He has some interesting observations. Here are excerpts from an article that appeared in the Los Angeles Times, January 26, 2001. Quote, "They, Enron, had a strategy, and it was to work from Washington down to the states. They won the battle at the federal level, and California came next. First, deregulation was supposed to create a competitive market in which hundreds of generators would provide abundant electricity at low prices. Toward this end, the state forced its utilities to sell off their power plants. These were snapped up by a few large, primarily Texas-based corporations. When no other players entered the market, the forced divestiture effectively turned a regulated monopoly into an unregulated cartel. Deregulation's second flaw was to set up a dysfunctional wholesale market that this generator cartel could easily manipulate. Generators could simply withhold power to bid up the price and then dump power at inflated prices. Ordinarily, this market manipulation would simply lead to higher electricity prices. However, California's utilities had agreed to freeze rates until the year 2002. The law's third flaw." End quote. John Rosa, an aide to California State Senator Steve Pace, who was the chairman of a legislative committee on deregulation, says, quote, "Enron's fingerprints are all over the dysfunctional parts of the market." End quote. In the smoking gun department, so far, few details of how the California system was designed are publicly known, but some other things are known. The 9 largest suppliers of power to California saw after-tax profits soar 54% in 2000 to nearly $8 billion. Enron recorded earnings of about $404 million in the second quarter of 2001, up 40% from the year before. One Enron trader working in the Portland office is credited with over $500 million in trades. I wonder what his Christmas bonus was like. This train of events has bankrupted the two largest California utilities, Pacific Gas and Electric, and Southern California Edison. The details of their bankruptcy are interesting. At some point, perhaps shortly after deregulation, California's utilities recognized the fix they were about to be in. The new rules required that they sell off their generating capacity, and they could not raise retail rates until 2002. Yet they were exposed to an unpredictable spot market with no way to hedge, long-term contracting having been outlawed in favor of a wholesale spot market. Sensing the gathering storm, they realized they were likely to be bled dry, so they took evasive action. Here's Peter Navarro again. Quote, "Southern California Edison paid a huge dividend to its shareholders, thus ridding itself of any excess cash to buy power. Both Edison and California's biggest investor-owned utility, PG&E, also moved assets over to their unregulated subsidiaries so that these assets couldn't be used as credit to purchase electricity. The result was that Enron and other generators could withhold power from these utilities, claiming they were afraid they wouldn't get paid. On this pretense, Enron also squirreled away nearly $1.5 billion in reserve funds that did not show up on their income statements during the power crisis. Later, they leaked the funds back into the revenue stream to manage profits, showing them to be predictable and increasing." As Navarro predicted, in January 2001, Pacific Gas and Electric sought bankruptcy protection in April 2001, owing Enron $500 million. Navarro once again writing in January 2001, "While the utilities want a bailout, the cartel wants to panic the governor into signing long-term contracts at inflated prices. The reason is simple. Soon, there will be a flood of newly constructed power plants glutting the California market. At the same time, natural gas prices are forecast to fall. The likelihood, then, is that the long-term cost of power will be in the 3 to 5 cent per kilowatt range, kilowatt hour. Thus, if the generator cartel can lock the state into contracts at 9 or 10 cents for 5 or 10 years, their continued exorbitant profits will be assured, end quote. This is exactly what has happened. California's Governor Davis, despite a howl of protests from the Republicans in the legislature, but facing an unknown market, signed $40 billion in forward contracts for power at a price far in excess of the normal wholesale market, about double today's rate. California has already spent more than $6 billion for power when Southern California Edison and PGE threatened blackouts because they could no longer buy power on credit in late 2000. But now, utilities and state governments are demanding their money back. Washington Attorney General Gregoire has filed several suits, and Governor Davis has demanded renegotiation. But there's dissension in the ranks. Supported by the Oregon Public Utilities Commission, Portland General Electric is crying the blues. Bob Valdez, a spokesman for the Oregon Public Utilities Commission, stated that, quote, "We oppose refunds because they could potentially harm Oregon consumers by driving up rates." Washington's Utilities and Transportation Commission takes a similar stance in support of Puget Power and Avista. Both Avista and PGE are alleged to have engaged in fraudulent power trading. Oregon's Attorney General Myers has remained mum, as has Idaho's, except to say that their position is that the AG office will provide legal advice and nothing more. Remember, the map of public utility district territory in the Northwest shows a heavy concentration of PUDs in Washington, with relatively few in Oregon or Idaho. Will FERC fix this? It appears they are potentially making it worse by insisting on a deregulated market for the Pacific Northwest.
You may ask yourself, am I right? Am I wrong? You may say to yourself, by God, what have I done?
Opponents include 7th District Congressman Jim McDermott, quoting him, "The RTO would be independent from everyone but FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. That means FERC would decide how our transmission lines are used. BPA's transmission business would no longer be conducted under the watchful eye of the elected Northwest Congressional delegation. Transmission lines owned by investor utilities no longer would be regulated by the Washington State Utilities and Transportation Commission. And transmission lines owned by the public utilities such as Seattle City Light no longer would be overseen by municipal governing bodies such as the Seattle City Council," end quote. This is an important story, but one that has not received much media attention in the Pacific Northwest. Our congressional delegation appears to be informed and concerned, as does our Attorney General. This program is copyright 2002 by ACE Productions, Seattle, Washington, all rights reserved. Permission has been granted for broadcast on non-commercial public radio stations. All other rights are reserved. For further information, contact this station or Tom Allen at thallen@nwlink.com.